Answering Contemporary Questions from Paul's Perspective, the 10th talk in a series on prayer, was presented by Ron Julian on February 28, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Well, we're going to continue our series on prayer this morning. I want to continue the topic that I started last week, where I'm trying to look at questions like these. I hope I'm managing to be clear about what the issue is in my mind as we get to the end of this, but there are questions like these that I think are very important ones, very relevant to the way the Christian culture in general tends to talk about prayer, as well as just the world in general. I mean, just the way we tend to think about it. So these are the sorts of questions I'm interested in. Is prayer a tool to make things happen? Is receiving God's blessing in this life dependent on knowing what and how to pray? Does getting many people to pray the same thing increase the odds that it will happen? Should we pray out of a sense that it all depends on me? If I pray, then good things will happen, and if I don't pray, then they won't. I hope the issue is clear in those questions. What I'm responding to is what I see around me, a certain emphasis on prayer that sees it kind of like a job that we're leaving undone. Like, if you don't paint your house every so often, then the moisture's going to get in and it's going to rot and the whole thing's going to fall down and it will have been your fault. There's a kind of emphasis on prayer, I think, that I see in the culture around that essentially upbraids us as believers for letting the house fall down and not using those tools that we have in our hands to keep things going. And so there are a variety of ways that that can come across. I've told you before about a speaker that I heard a number of years ago, very well-known person in the evangelical community, who was talking about, he's looking at various parts of the world and talking about all of the difficulties, how this country's falling apart and this country's falling apart. And his exhortation to us was, the reason that those countries are falling apart is that the church is not praying. If we were praying, then those things would not be happening. So to the extent that there is trouble in the world, that shows how much the church has fallen down on the job. To the extent that the walls in the house are starting to get squishy, that shows the extent to which you haven't been maintaining things. It's that kind of thinking that I'm talking about. What I want to do today is look at a series of passages that all basically explore the same theme. These are passages where, in one way or another, Paul is encouraging, urging, asking, talking about the people that he's writing to praying for him. Okay, so here's Paul writing to people about their prayers for his ministry, for his life, for the things that are happening to him. And I'd kind of like to look at a couple of those passages and explore this issue of what Paul's perspective is on why it is these people are praying for him. Because actually, I think, at first reading, some of these passages sound as if it might be that Paul has this perspective that somehow the more people he can get on his side, if he can get people praying for him, that's going to make it more likely that things will go well. And so that's the question I want to explore. And we'll see how we do. These are the kinds of passages that are sort of deceptively simple, and you can tell me at the end whether I've managed to tell you what I'm trying to get across here. Let's go to 2 Corinthians first. We're in chapter 1. We'll start in verse 8. You know, we have the problem in these cases that we're jumping into contexts in the middle, and I'll try to, as much as I can, bring us up to speed, but there's a lot that will probably remain unsaid. Starting in verse 8 of chapter 1, 2 Corinthians, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, we have the sentence of death within ourselves, in order that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God, who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a peril of death, and will deliver us, he on whom we have set our hope. And he will yet deliver us, you also joining in helping us through your prayers, that thanks may be given by many persons on our behalf for the favor bestowed upon us through the prayers of many." Okay? So, here's Paul writing to the church in Corinth. He's talking about his experiences in Asia. He said this is the time when he was living in Ephesus and the area around. And if you go and read in the book of Acts, you'll see that he had a lot of problems while he was there. He lived there for several years, and there were numerous difficulties that he faced. He describes himself here as burdened beyond our strength. So if you can picture that, I mean, I don't have any difficulty picturing that kind of scenario, that where the burden of whatever the situation is, it feels like more than I can bear. And that's what he was saying. This situation in Asia, it's not just that it presented a danger and a difficulty to him, but it weighed upon him as a danger and a difficulty. This was something that was really difficult for him to go through. He describes himself as having the sentence of death within himself so that he might trust in the God who raises the dead. And I think I understand what he's saying here. The thing that I'm picturing is he's talking about being burdened beyond his strength. This situation, the opposition he faced, the physical and mental burdens that it placed on him, the danger to his life, and the emotional weight of all of this situation was such that he felt that he himself couldn't handle it. It was more than he could take. And I think that idea of having the sentence of death within himself, it's the idea, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is over. This is going to do me in. I don't feel like I have what it takes to solve this problem. And yet, he says, he has put his hope in the God who raises the dead. He's aware, even as his strength is going, and he just can't see his way to make this thing work, he has confidence in the God who raises the dead, the God who is not thwarted, the one who is not daunted by whatever seems so big to us. So, he's talking about a very personal expression of his own faith and trust in God. At a time when it was very difficult, he has the confidence that God, the God who raises the dead, can deliver him from this situation. He talks about not trusting in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and will deliver us. There's a couple of ways that you could picture what he's saying here. He might just be saying, in the past, in this situation, he did deliver us from what was going on, and my confidence is that he will continue to do so. And that makes perfect sense in the context, and that may be what he means. It strikes me that he might be stepping back and giving the basis for his confidence that God is going to be good to him in the present distress, in that he's looking at what God has done in the past. The so great a death that he's talking about might not be the great burden that he faced in Asia, but the bigger problem of his life as a human being, his his slavery to sin and death and condemnation, that he might be saying, I look at God, he is the one who delivered me from so great a death, from the death that awaits me as a sinner and one who stands condemned. He has delivered me from eternal death and will deliver me. On that day comes when the judgment is to be made, I'm confident that that deliverance will come home, and thus I am confident that he will deliver me in the present distresses that I am in. That seems possible to me as well. At any rate, Paul is appealing to his knowledge of who God is, the big picture of the God who is thwarted by nothing, the God whose love reaches past even death, to picture how he expects God to deal with him in the midst of the distresses of his life, and in particular in his ministry. We'll see when we come to the next passage that never far from Paul's mind, I think, is his particular circumstance as a minister of the gospel. This is not just, I had a really bad cold and I asked him to deliver me from it, but the distresses that he's taking on here are the distresses that have come to him as a minister of the gospel. And part of his confidence, as we'll see, it relates to his understanding of what it is that God is doing with him as a minister of the gospel. But nonetheless, his confidence here is applicable to most any situation if we ask ourselves the question, can I count on the love of God and the power of God to be on my side in the midst of the distresses of my life? Yes, and that's the picture that Paul is operating out of. Now, he says, here we come now to the phrase, the sentence that's interesting to us, where he says, he will yet deliver us, you also joining in helping us through your prayers, that thanks may be given by many persons on our behalf for the favor bestowed upon us through the prayers of many. Here's how I picture what's happening here. We have to remember the general confidence that Paul has already expressed in God's goodness and power on his behalf. Paul himself has already cried out to God in the midst of those distresses with the confidence that God is the one who raises the dead and who can redeem and rescue him in this situation. Paul here says, you also join in helping through your prayers. Let's think for a second about what kind of help he's talking about in the light of what we've already seen about his attitude. Does Paul mean, unless I can get enough of you praying for me, God is going to let these burdens crush and destroy me? So I'm really glad that you're all in there pitching and praying on my behalf, because otherwise God is just going to leave me twisting in the wind. I don't see how we could possibly think that's true. When we go through Paul's letters, there is no sense in which his confidence in God's goodness on his behalf is contingent on getting enough people to pray for him. Even in those situations where everyone has abandoned him, and he describes that sort of thing sometimes, he still has confidence that God is going to do right by him. So, it seems to me that Paul has already shown that God's great love and power that he has shown in salvation gives Paul the expectation that God is on his side and will deliver him. So what is it that he's getting at when he talks to them here? He talks about them joining in helping through their prayers. So Paul cries out to God when the burdens of his ministry come upon him. What is it that he is hoping that the Corinthians will do when they hear of the kinds of burdens and difficulties that are on Paul? He hopes that they will care about what happens to him and cry out to God as well. He wants their hearts to be caught by this picture of him in trouble. This is Paul. This is the one that Jesus chose to be an apostle of the gospel. This is the one who brought the gospel to us, who showed us the light. And here he is struggling and in difficulty and facing great burdens and the threat of death. What ought I to be thinking in a situation like that? Well, hopefully I'm concerned about Paul. This is a scary and difficult thing for me as well, because his ministry means a great deal to me. So, what is it that they will do in that situation? They'll cry out to God. They'll say, God, help Paul. And the way Paul describes it, when God, as Paul is confident that he will do, delivers him, then there will be many people, not just Paul, to be grateful for God's deliverance, but all those people who were praying and asking God to deliver Paul have the opportunity and experience of being grateful for God's response. God delivered Paul. That's what we wanted. We're going to talk about this more, but it seems to me that there are these two ideas that have to fit together. On the one hand, God is not dependent on me praying to make things happen. And yet, in life, we do have the opportunity of experiencing calling out to God and having his response, so that we can experience that and be grateful for the way he's responded. Both of those things are true. If we emphasize one of the or the other of them too much, I think we get a distorted picture of how prayer is meant to work. And I suppose you can tell that I tend to think that the church today has emphasized too much the asking and response part of this picture, and not enough the sovereign grace of God reaching out to accomplish his good purposes for us, whether we pray for it or not. It's putting those two things together that we're trying to do. Now, I think if you'll go with me to the second passage, we can see these same themes, and I think some of the things that I've been arguing come out a little clearer there. We're going to Philippians, the first chapter. We talked a little bit about Philippians a couple of weeks ago, I think. You may or may not recall that this is a letter that is being written while Paul is imprisoned. And we want to start, let me read verse 12 to you. Now, I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. And so he goes on to talk about the impact of his imprisonment on the state of the preaching of the gospel. And to the extent that that's been a good thing, he's happy about that. What I want to look at is starting in verse 19, where he says, "For I know that this shall turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that I shall not be put to shame in anything, but that with all boldness Christ shall even now, as always, be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. But I am hard pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. And convinced of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that your proud confidence in me may abound in Christ Jesus through my coming to you again." Okay, so there's just one little phrase in here that I'm concerned with, but we have to kind of look at the whole big piece to see what's going on. Paul is writing to them with the expectation that he is going to be released. He knows, in fact, that it is possible that he will die. He's in prison, his case may go against him, and he may end up being executed. That's a possibility. Nonetheless, his expectation is that that is not what is going to happen. And I think it's a powerful picture that he paints of how his thinking goes, the way he's thinking about this. His confidence is, his hope and expectation, because of the work that God has done in him, because of what he knows to be true about the kind of person that he is coming to be through the work of the Spirit of God, he knows that his expectation is that Christ will be exalted by his life or by his death. Okay? Yeah, well, somebody for sure better get that call in. Okay. Exalted by his life or by his death. And I think what he's talking about here is, look, here I am in prison. If I live, I expect that my life will exalt Christ. I plan to continue to preach. I plan to continue to be faithful, to embrace the faith myself and explain that faith to other people. So my life will exalt Christ as he intended. I have been chosen to be one who is to take the message of Christ to the world. So in that sense, if I live, I will exalt Christ. But if I die, if I remain faithful to the gospel and don't recant, and I'm executed for it, that will exalt Christ as well. Whether I live or whether I die, I don't expect to be put to shame. I am going to be faithful either way. If I live, I will be faithful. If I die, I will be faithful. And either way, Christ will be exalted. That's his earnest expectation and hope, that he will not be put to shame in whatever happens. However this happens, in the end, it will exalt Christ, whether he lives or whether he dies. Now he looks at that question, so which do I want? Either one will exalt Christ. If I remain faithful, then both of them will end up exalting Christ. So which is better? Should they execute me or should I be released? What do I want? And his answer is essentially, well, if I was to think about that just in terms of what would be best for me personally, to be with Christ is better. I'd be better off if they executed me and we ended it now. You understand, this is not a despairing, suicidal sort of comment that Paul's making. He's just saying, look, I have such confidence that the reality of life is that life with Christ is the only real life to be found, that to go to end my race here on earth is not a bad thing. I'm moving on to a better thing if that were to happen. But if I stay, this will mean fruitful labor for you. I'm an apostle. I know things you don't know. I can encourage you in ways that you don't even understand. I have a lot to teach you. I have a lot to say to you. And my being around means that I have the opportunity to do that, and you have the opportunity to benefit. And so his conclusion at the end is, I think I'm going to stay around. Not, I've decided to stay, but rather, as I look at the situation, as I think about this the way God would think about it, I look at his faithfulness towards me, I look at how I expect to be faithful both in life and death. When I look at the whole scenario and put it all together, I think that what God's going to do is release me, and I will be available to come to you, to teach you, to encourage you. That's what I expect. Although, I'm prepared for either. I'm prepared for death. That would be just as acceptable to me, whichever God gives me. So, I think it's important to recognize here that this whole picture is Paul's ruminating on what it is that God is doing with his life. What is it that God has called me to do? So on the one hand, his hope and expectation that in the end, I should say his expectation that in the end he will be released and be available to teach them, this is not based on his understanding that if he gets enough Corinthians praying for him, then he'll get out of jail. This is totally based on his understanding of what God, in his sovereign purposes for Paul's life, has decided to do. And what Paul is saying is, I think I understand this well enough to know that God has more for me to do. And so that's what's going to happen. That's how I understand what he's saying here. And we don't know for sure, but tradition tells us that in fact Paul did get out, that he was right about this, and went on to Spain as he had said he hoped to do, and ended up being arrested again later in his life. It seems most reasonable to put the picture together that the Philippian letter, talking about being imprisoned, is his first imprisonment that we read about at the end of the book of Acts. Later on in his letters to Timothy, I think, isn't that where he talks about his departure is imminent and that sort of thing? I may be remembering that wrong, but there again we see an imprisonment sort of picture, and this time it seems like it's the next time he's imprisoned. This time he does not have the expectation that he's going to get out, but this is the end. Okay, so now Paul has this understanding, certainly of the faithfulness of God, but his expectation that this is what God has in mind for me. And yet, he uses this language, for I know that this shall turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Again, obviously, Paul does not see his future as being in the hands of the Corinthians. If enough of you pray, this is going to happen. Paul, instead, I think, just has this picture, the same one that we saw before, that his hope is that the Corinthians, excuse me, I keep saying the Corinthians, we were in Corinthians a minute ago, we're in Philippians now, that the Philippians in this situation will care about him, see his situation, he's imprisoned, and they, like he, are calling out to God to deliver Paul, bring him back to us, we need him. And that his expectation is that the purposes of God, the work of the Spirit, is that's something that's happening together with their cries, with their calling to God. Now, to maybe fill in that picture a little bit to see how would those things work together? Why would he be concerned about such a thing? Let me take us to one more passage, and then at the end you can tell me whether these passages are coming together and making sense. I want to take us to Romans 15. 15, yes. 1:5, and we're towards the end in verse 30. Romans 15:30. Now I urge you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from those who are disobedient in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints, so that I may come to you in joy by the will of God and find refreshing rest in your company. Okay. Now, you may remember what the situation here is. Paul is writing to the Romans. He has never been to Rome. He's writing here to forestall problems that he sees possibly arising. He knows that they have the possibility at least of hearing some teaching from opponents of the gospel that could unsettle them, and he's writing in essence to make his case for the gospel against the kinds of arguments that they would hear from those opponents. And he very much wants to go himself to Rome to be able to talk to them in person and to teach them in person, and as he says, encourage them and impart a gift of the Spirit, a spiritual gift to them by teaching and encouraging them. This is what he wants. And you may remember in the first chapter, he talks about how he's always praying to God that he may at last finally make it to Rome. He emphasizes there that it is by the will of God that he will make it to Rome. He has wanted to get there for some time, and it has not happened. It's something that he is hoping is going to happen, and he is hoping that it is the will of God that he do so, and he keeps asking, "Can I please go to Rome?" And we know how things turn out in the end. Notice what he says here. The prayers that he's asking for are that I may be delivered from those who are disobedient in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints. Well, that first thing, that I may be delivered from those who are disobedient in Judea, he knows that he has enemies there. He knows that there's a potential that they can arrest him, kill him. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that could happen. His hope is he will be delivered from them so that he can fulfill his intention to go to Spain and to go there by way of Rome so that he can visit Rome. Well, we know what happened. It wasn't quite that way. Paul didn't get to Rome by being delivered from his enemies. He got to Rome by being delivered into the hands of his enemies. It was by being arrested by his enemies and appealing to Caesar that the Roman government ended up taking him to Rome in chains. So that's how it ends up. His prayers here, though you can see, I mean, I would in the same spot, I mean, my hope is that I can get to Rome. How else am I going to get there unless that I make it through Jerusalem, I eventually escape the clutches of whatever problems would be there so that I'm free to travel on? It seems to be the picture that he's painting. That's what he's asking them to pray for, that I will be able to escape whatever problems I'm going to run into in Jerusalem so that I can come around and see you. That's not quite how it worked in the end. The very problems that he wanted to be freed from are the means God used to get him there. I suppose I can comment briefly on the language that his service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints. I'm not entirely sure what's happening there. I'm assuming what it sounds like to me by the service to Jerusalem, this is the time when he has been gathering money from the Gentile churches. He's gathered money from Corinth. We see it in the Corinthian letters. And he's on his way to Jerusalem to deliver this money for famine relief. And presumably, what I'm thinking is that that's what he's talking about. Somehow, his hope is that he's going to bring this to the Jerusalem church and that that will be satisfactory, and he can go on his way to Rome with joy, with the knowledge that he successfully fulfilled his commission to help alleviate this financial problem that was in Jerusalem. If he means something else, I'm not sure what it would be. I think that's it. But what he's seeing is, look, I have potential roadblocks in Jerusalem, and if you want me to get there, you should be praying, God, help him get past these roadblocks so that he can get to Rome. But notice, again, we see the tension in this kind of prayer. Paul sees his coming to Rome as being entirely in the hands of God. It is the will of God that has kept him from Rome so far, even though he's asked and asked. God wants him to do something else. And even here, when he's asking them to pray for me that I might come to Rome by the will of God. Ultimately, this is God's decision. And yet he urges them by the love of the Spirit to pray for him. I think what's significant is this language, strive together with me in your prayers for me. Here are the Romans that he doesn't know personally, most of them. What does he want? He wants for them to engage their hearts and their imaginations on his behalf. Is Paul just some guy, some traveling preacher that might come through sometime, and if he manages to get here, maybe we can set aside an afternoon to have a little meeting with him or something? That shouldn't be the attitude that they have toward him. This is the apostle to the Gentiles. This is Paul, chosen by Jesus himself, the man who has faced death and hardship in order to bring the gospel to the world. This is a very important person for what he can bring them, for the teaching that he can bring them, for the way he can correct them and encourage them. His difficulties should be theirs in a very real sense, and the hope that he should come to Rome should be as strong on their side as it is on his side. He keeps praying, may I get to Rome? Why? Because he knows that there are a group of Christians there that he has never met. It's a big city. It's an influential city. There are a lot of influences on them. They're hearing a lot of stuff. He wants to get there and have a chance to talk to them, to see how they're doing, to feel them out, to encourage them, to remind them what's true. So he's very burdened by this. He wants to get there. But he wants, on their part, that there be a love that motivates them to be praying the same thing on the other side. We really want Paul to get here. We really would like to hear from him. We would like him to have the opportunity to teach us and encourage us. That's something we really desire to happen. And so he's saying, I want you to work together with me. You know, you're there and I'm here, but are we in this thing together? I want us to be in this together. So I want your hearts to be set on this as much as my heart is set on it. And so you be praying. What? Take the desires of your heart to God, and I'm hoping that those desires are that I would come and be with you. So, again, it seems to me that these two ideas fit together. On the one hand, Paul doesn't see prayer as a tool to manipulate God into getting what he wants. He is at the disposal of God. God is going to decide what is best, and Paul knows that. But at the same time, Paul sees himself in a personal interaction with God where the desires of his heart he pours out to him. He points to it in the first chapter, remember we talked to this about this, as evidence of how much he cares about the Romans. You want to know how much I care about you? You're on my mind all the time. I'm worried about you. I want to get a chance to come to you. And you know how you can know that's true? Because I'm always praying. Every time I pray, you guys come to mind, and I say, God, please take care of them, and may I be able to get there and preach to them, encourage them. The fact is, it's on my mind, and so I'm always talking to God about it, asking him to do something about it. I want that to be true for you guys, he's saying. I want this to be on your minds. Not, I want you to get in there praying because it's more likely to happen if you do, but rather, I want you to be people who are working together with me. This is as important to you as it is to me, and you express that in your prayers as well. Not that he sees his getting to Rome as being contingent on whether he gets enough people to pray for it, but that he wants them to be people who care about it enough to pray for it. Okay, so in the end, what I see in these kinds of passages in Paul, his concerns are like this. Are your hearts with me? Do you care about the gospel? Are my troubles a concern to you as well? When my troubles become your burdens as well, then you should take them to God, the way I do, Paul's saying. He's not trying to recruit more votes in order to make God act. He is looking for hearts that are laboring together with him. They're concerned about what he's concerned about, and so they're praying about the same thing. And everyone who prays with Paul can experience the satisfaction of watching God's faithfulness. They can see how, in fact, God is faithful to Paul and is delivering him from his various troubles. Now, there's a couple of last things I want to say here. One thing, afterwards last week, someone asked me a question that I thought was a good question that is very much related to what we're talking about here. The question was about Christian groups that are very concerned with evangelism, and they'll do things like publishing lists of, you know, statistics. Here are the, you know, the most Christians per capita and the least Christians per capita and so on, so that we know how to strategically target our prayers. And we can pray for those places where the gospel seems to be making the least headway or has been heard the least or has been responded to the least or something like that. And the question was, you know, is that a good thing or not? Should we, you know, we get together prayer teams to strategically target the things that we're going to pray for? Well, my answer then, and it would be the same right now, is that that could be a very good thing and it could be a very bad thing. It all depends on what's happening in the hearts of the people who are involved with this. On the one hand, I think we see in Paul's letters here his hope that the people he's writing to would be so concerned about the progress of the gospel and about him as a minister of the gospel that would be on their hearts and that would be something that would drive them to God to pray about. So in that sense, it seems to me that I can be involved in that sort of thing out of the attitude, the gospel really matters to me. For people to come to a knowledge of the truth is a wonderful and delightful thing. It is the best thing that could happen in the life of any human being. And so when I see something like the statistics that are drawn up, that speaks to me, and I pray to God, God, I really want your gospel to have an impact in the world. And look at this place where it seems to be having so little impact, you know, please do something. That seems to me to be a very right and appropriate sort of response, and that there can be people involved in things like that whose attitude is very good, very right before God, and can be a very commendable thing. It seems to me, on the other hand, though, that I have seen it quite possible for that sort of thing to be, let me just put it bluntly, to be a very bad thing. There is this approach to prayer that is no different than the approach that any pagan takes to prayer. It's that idea, it is the magic incantation with which I can change the world to my liking. It's the magic power ritual. We can bend reality to our will if we get the numbers together to pray for it to happen. I think that's a spiritually dangerous place to be. And that sometimes that sort of, let's get the numbers together and then marshal our forces. Let's gather together and march around the city 7 times and claim it for God and that kind of thing. There's a difference between having a desire for the things of God in this world and turning to God in hope and trust that He will accomplish those things. There's a difference between that and having the presumption to say, I've got the power to change the world. I have the magic tool. So that's what I'm trying to get across here. What I see in Paul's talking to these folks about praying for him is not, you have the power, we have the power, let's use the power and things will happen, but rather, my heart is set on my ministry, the difficulties in my ministry, the progress of the gospel and these things, and I'm hoping and asking that you care enough about those things to work together with me, to have your heart set on those things, and thus, those are the sorts of things that you would take to God, because they're of concern to you. If you're worried about me, then pray for my deliverance. If you're confident that God is working in my ministry, then be thankful to Him that this wonderful thing is happening. Always, when we come to talk about a topic like this, in the end, we sort of face the question, are our prayers meaningless then in the light of this, or what's going on? We seem to get ourselves in a spot where either prayer is the magic power ritual with which I can change the world, in which sense it makes sense for me to pray because I've got the tool, or else if I see a picture of the sovereign God who has decided the course that my life is going to take, and it's really in His hands and His will, and I have no tool to bend Him to my purposes, then why do I bother to pray in the first place? But the biblical picture, as I'm understanding it, doesn't take either one of those extremes. What it says is, yes, God's sovereign purpose will be done in my life. But at the same time, in the arena of that sovereignty, I am a person interacting with my Creator. And He has given me the freedom to go to Him with my concerns, to take what is on my mind and talk to Him and ask Him to do something. And that in that situation, it's meaningful to ask Him to do something. He is not dependent on our prayers, but He does respond to them. So the kinds of scenarios, the way I see the Christian life playing itself out, it is not a picture where I have to figure out what to pray for and how to pray for so that I can make the good things happen. The scenarios instead run something like this. First of all, God does many, many, many good things that I never thought of and never prayed about, and it never would have occurred to me. And He does it sovereignly without my advice or help or request. Secondly, God does some good things in my life and in other people's lives by bringing me to that place in life where I pray to Him, where I call out to Him, and then He responds, and I have the experience of asking and receiving what I asked for. And in that situation, I can experience the joy, the gratitude, like the Corinthians experienced when Paul was delivered as they asked God to do. Many could give thanks for what happened. And yet, God does some good things by saying no to my prayers. And in that process, to teach me and mature me and bring about a greater good ultimately in my life than I could have brought about through my own desires. So, is prayer a tool to change things? No, not really. Is it meaningful for me to take my concerns to God? Is he just going to ignore them and say, oh, I already know what I'm going to do? No. It is meaningful to go to him because I am a human being interacting with my Creator. And I go to him the way a child would go to a parent. I know you care about me. Here is my trouble. And the parent will say, I see your trouble. Let me help you. Or the parent will say, you don't understand your real problem, but I do. So I'm not going to solve your problem the way you want me to. It's going to be solved a different way. That is a, to me, is a powerful analogy because we have an opportunity in real life to see the way love can say no. Love says no a lot. Any of you thinking, if you have the opportunity to think about those parent-child relationships that you've seen where there is love in action, the fact is that love says no a lot, and so does God. But the interaction is a meaningful one, and it's important to us to come to know the God we're dealing with by going to him and coming to understand what he's about. Okay, so that's how I would answer the questions that I'm raising here. Now, you tell me, do you have some response or questions or anything we could explore for a couple minutes?
Do you ever think there's a situation where God God doesn't give us something that we want specifically because we didn't ask him for it? That one could actually say, as whoever seems to be saying you don't have because you don't ask. One of the things that I have in mind is the Catholic Church, one of the Catholic Church teachings. There's this rosary where you say the same prayers in a particular sequence over and over and over again. And the rosary got a big boost when Mary, the mother of Jesus, apparently appeared in Fatima, Portugal, around the end of the First World War. And she said that, among other things, pray the rosary, and if you don't pray the rosary, a worse war is going to happen. Of course, you don't find out until later that this prophecy, the person who received that prophecy didn't tell anybody about it until there actually was a Second World War. But
what a cynical comment that was, Margaret.
that kind of thing is brought up a lot when I talk to people about that, you don't have because you don't ask kind of thing. It seemed to me that if it's really good for me, God's going to give it to me even if, as you said, even if I don't ask. So what's going on there?
Right. Well, the passage you don't have because you don't ask is one we're still going to have to talk about in James. I'm going to have one. I mean, we've gone through James before in this group, so I don't want to beat it to death, but there are three passages in James that are very relevant to this discussion about prayer. The one about praying for wisdom, the one where it says you don't have because you don't ask, and the one about the elders praying for healing at the end. And I want to kind of look at those three together and comment on how I think the church has skewed what it is that James is getting at there in the wrong direction. My answer would be, God, I have God's assurance that he is working in my life all things together for my good. So that I have this foundation that I'm standing on, that I am confident that I'm not going to miss out ultimately on good through my ignorance or even foolishness, that God is delivering me from folly if I indeed have put my trust in Him. So in that sense, yeah, that's the bottom line. Now, I think it's entirely possible that God, in dealing with me on an individual basis, could have, for my ultimate good, an instructive event where somehow I have always taken a certain area of my life and seen it as apart from God. You know, I've seen it as somehow all in my control and it has nothing to do with Him. And I might find myself frustrated there, only to finally sort of wake up and realize, why have I never taken this burden to God? And upon taking it to Him, finding a solution to this problem that I had never found before. I'm just making that up. But why? Sure. That could happen, I think. But that, on an individual level, what's happening in that particular case is not, it's not this profound truth that nothing comes to me in life until I figure out to push the button, but it's God using a particular situation to get across to me, hey, you know, I'm the Lord of all of life. This is not, you have your little religious part over here and then the rest of life. And He might very well have me experience something like that. That seems entirely possible to me. But you understand the difference. That's different than saying my attitude is essentially God has given me this task to figure out the path and make it happen by praying for it. I mean, my attitude towards all of those places in the world where the gospel has not made its progress is not, oh gosh, the church hasn't prayed enough there. But God's sovereign purposes are happening in the world, and I will pray to Him to bring light into the darkness, but I'm confident that He doesn't need me to make that happen. Now, in a particular place in my life, yes, it may be that I need to learn the lesson that God needs to be brought into the picture. I may be, you know, maybe in my finances or something, I'm just totally worldly. I just think about it in terms of, you know, buying and selling and investing and you know, without any real thought to the kind of thing that Jesus says about, you know, not being anxious for tomorrow and God being the one who cares for all the sparrows and something. And it might very well be in that spot that God might sort of, for that particular season and issue, might be saying essentially, sooner or later you're going to figure out that I'm here, that I'm not irrelevant to this thing, and that might make a difference. Sure. Okay, over here. You're welcome.
Appreciate that. I'd like to express what I hear you saying,
okay,
and then if I could expound upon that and then hear what your reaction would be back.
Okay. Great.
In this passage and in a lot of Paul's writings, I feel and I sense a lot of compassion for God, of course, but also for His readers, for the people that He longed to be with, and He seemed to long for their prayers. I heard you saying that He wanted the Corinthians to be caught up with Paul's struggles so that when God provides, they all may rejoice together. And then in Romans, that He wants them to engage their hearts and imagination on His behalf. He wants them to be in this together, working together. This kind of thinking excites me. Just the way Paul expresses his love for God and his love for his scattered congregations, mm-hmm, and the people he's contacted with. He seems to want to share God's love and his own love for them and their lives, and that they may mature and become whole. I wish that more leaders and teachers in modern times would express their love and compassion for the people that are around them. I've heard it said, for one psychologist in training, he took a coffee cup in during a therapy session, and his mentor said, never do that. You cannot let your people know that you have needs, and food and drink is a need.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, we're supposed to be some kind of superhuman. I think that's the model that a lot of people take in life, that we cannot let down our guard to let others know that we have needs.
Right.
And that grieves me, because I know I have needs, my wife have needs, and I expect that other people do.
Right.
And so I wonder, to what extent can we wish and hope for others to join with us in our own struggles? They may not be as noble and as pure as Paul's was, that he had some pretty big things going on for God, but it seems that all of our maturity and growth and the day-to-day struggles, no matter how mundane, they would be helped a lot if we knew that we were in them together with other people. And so that when, as we mature, and when we see some milestone, we can rejoice together in that.
Right.
I'd like to hear your comments.
Right. Well, I think that's right. I would make... You have to understand the sort of person I am. It's not possible for me to talk about something without making a distinction. You have to make a distinction about something. It's not worth opening your mouth unless you've made a distinction about something. So I kind of look at a set of motivations that Paul would talk about. And one of the motivations I think that's kind of preeminent in these passages is related to, it's unique to him in that he is an apostle of the gospel. It really, really would be screaming out loud about my attitudes and my priorities in life if Paul were living among us and I could be indifferent to whether he came to see us or not, whether he prospered or not, whether he had the opportunity to preach the gospel or not. I mean, if I could be indifferent to those things, then that says something really big about me. But at the same time, as I think I've tried to emphasize quite a few times as we have gone along through this stuff, another one of the motivations to us as believers is that when we look at each other, I'm not looking out at a sea of apostles to the Gentiles. I know that none of you out there is Paul, so none of you has that sort of claim on my loyalties and my submission that Paul as an apostle has. But each of you is a human being joining me in this quest for the kingdom of God. Each of you is a human being who has heard the gospel, at least you say you have, and you are looking to inherit what I am looking to inherit. And what that means then is in that phenomenon of human relationships and how they come to the bonds that come to join people together, you and I have an invisible bond. What I mean is, if we were co-owners of a piece of property, we would have a visible bond. The piece of property would be the bond that ties us together, and we'd get together and talk about it and plan, and when the values went up, we'd say hooray, and you know, we would rejoice around this thing. You and I have a bond that is invisible, and the strength of that bond, it seems to me, depends on the amount to which the reality of that invisible inheritance is coming home to us. You come to mean more to me as my brother or sister in Christ, the more Christ comes to mean to me. If he doesn't mean much to me, then the fact that you're my brother and sister in Christ can't mean that much to me either.